My name is Terry Smith and I'm an artist. I've been working for 20 years now, making work in different parts of the world. Mainly I call them interventions into spaces. So they could be in buildings, or could be sometimes outside. I tend to make work with whatever's available. So I've been invited to do things in Zurich. Often with those kind of shows, I turn up on the Monday, the private views on the Friday. The show's titled, the cards are out, and I haven't got any work yet. And I just spend that week in the space, finding something to make a work about. Most recently was a project in Caracas, working with a choir. I went there originally in 1995 to do a project, to be part of an exhibition called Interventions in Space. And I met the director of the museum actually in London. I had a show in a place called the Adam Gallery in South London. And she saw the work and it seemed to fit with the show she was planning. So I got invited to go down there and I made a work in the museum. Four works actually in the museum. Three cutout wall cuttings and one audio piece. And so I went there for a month and worked there for a month and made the work there. So I went back again and the work was meant to be temporary, but in fact the work stayed up. So I heard different rumours that it was still there. One piece in particular, which is in a corridor between the two museums. And I got an email from the Ministry of Culture saying that the work needs to be restored or it's something happening and can I come out and look at it? So I said yes, but I can't come right now and I'd rather come for a more meaningful visit than just simply looking at a wall. They said, oh, well, come be part of this show. It's a kind of performance show. And I said, okay, I need to work with the choir. They got a choir organised. So I went to do two things, which is work with this choir and to look at this wall. And actually, the work was fine, but the wall was dampening it, and that's the problem. So I said, okay, fine, the work can go. I have no reason to keep it. It was never meant to be permanent anyway. It's just unusual that this work, of all my work, has stayed up. Most of it's destroyed. All of it's destroyed, apart from this work. So I had a problem with it going. What I didn't realise was that it was political. That the reason for the work being taken out wasn't because it was deteriorating or anything like that. It's because they didn't like the fact that it was contemporary art, and because the ministry in Venezuela had a kind of vendetta against contemporary art. Chavez came to visit the museum. It was boarded up, so he couldn't see it. And that caused outrage in the city because the people cared about the work and they had to be unveiled again and taken off. I didn't know any of this. Later, I realised, because I got reports back, that there was a Facebook campaign against the demolition of the work. So I went back there again to do this other project, again to work with the choir. And we had the public meeting that I went to, that I spoke at. And I explained to the people there, and they were happy with me. I took the work down myself. I struck the first blow on the piece, and I think that was important. And the museum staff that had cared for the work kind of realised it had to go and everything. And so everyone was kind of happy with it. But I was unhappy with the fact that I'd been used to do this, that it wasn't something about the work. It was simply about they didn't like the work, or the director didn't like the work, or the ministry didn't like the work. So at this meeting, which was in April this year, I apologised to people and said it was my presumption that this was my work and I had a right to say it could go, but it isn't my work anymore. It's been taken over by the people there and they loved the work and cared for it and wanted it to be up. And really, I made a mistake. So it was very peculiar for me because I have no interest in the work. I have no sentimental value about the work at all. But I was sentimental about the people that cared for it. And that they could care for any work of art. It wasn't that it was my work, the fact that they took it to their hearts and it was important. So I just thought it was a very important part of my life to realise that I didn't own it. You know, I haven't cut things out for probably 5 years now since I did the last piece I cut out. In a way, I'd prefer to do that more than anything else. I think I didn't even, if you pardon the pun, scratch the surface with that work yet. There's still a lot more to do there. I just had to respond to environments. You know, sometimes I just didn't get a building where I could do those things too. But my energy towards the work has never varied much. You know, I've never been interested once it's done. You know, I've loved the process of making the work. I like the people I meet when I'm working there, like in Venezuela. You know, I got very attached to the people. And I did projects in Barcelona or in Germany. The thing I look back on that I enjoy the most was the collaborations or the meetings with people, discussions and the talks. And that, for me, is what's substantial about the work. You know, the work itself, I don't give, you know, I don't care about either way, really. And I don't know why that is. I don't have no sentimental value to it. The drawings are slightly different, I think, in a way. They're more personal. But in a way, even the drawings I could lose probably the only thing that I do that I couldn't bear to lose are my notebooks. The things I do constantly all the time when I'm in cafes and bars and stuff, I'm always writing something. And anything I've written on, I find very hard to throw away. But drawings, I could throw away. Videos, they could burn up. I did a project a few years ago, and I was editing up to the last minute, so I had 3 days before the show opened, and my hard drive broke. I lost everything, the whole thing. So I had to go start from scratch with it again. And I quite like that. That wasn't a problem for me to do that, because in a way it gave me a chance to relook at the material again, because sometimes when you're editing over and over and over, you get stuck in the kind of groove of it. And so it's good to have a fresh look at it. But in a way, if the work hadn't worked, and I'd have done something else. And I think that's what artists are like, you know, is that you kind of, you know, when I do shows, when things go wrong, you know, I love it when things go wrong. Because that's when I go to work, that's when I think, okay, what we got? Okay, so the video projector doesn't work, right, we've got a wall, we can draw on the wall, we can cut the wall, we can find some furniture, we can cut it up, we can play with it. And so, you know, I'm usually not phased out by that thing at all. I guess I've always liked the idea of leaving nothing behind. You know, you find things out about yourself when you do shows. But I found out that when I finish a show, I'm very meticulous about clearing up, sweeping up, getting every remains of me there out of the building. And I didn't think about doing that. I just do that automatically. So there's something about me that I've found out that likes to not be there in a strange way. I mean, the commercial thing, lots of people, friends of mine, that very commercial work and sell work. And I think that's absolutely fine. I have nothing against that at all. I don't think that that's a compromise, actually, at all. I think poverty is a bigger compromise. Not having any money at all is a compromise. But I guess I've never, ever been interested in money at all. But I'm interested in what it can buy. My work, I think most artists' work, is packed full of contradictions. You know, that's fine. I don't think it has to be on message. You know, you can do work that does different things, that has different values to it. And rather than try and tidy that up and kind of think, let's make it consistent here, leave it as it is, leave it rough around the edges. I did a show once, actually, at the Adam Gallery, when I think it was the first time I'd shown this work in public. Because the other work was done secretly. And there's a pile of rubble on the ground, and some kids came in, and the kids are friends. And they were just jumping around in this gravel, and it really pissed me off. I just thought, I didn't think I was precious about it at all. But I was, you know, because there was a kind of integrity to the fact that what had fallen down had stayed where it fell. So when someone came in, they saw exactly what I'd left. You know, I walked away at that point, and they came in at that point. So to have someone kick it around and then mess it up, I didn't remake it again, disturbed me. So I had to stop them from doing it and got really quite annoyed with it. And I realised then that that bothered me, and I didn't know that until that point. And I think that's what's interesting about showing work, is it tests you in different kind of ways. And I think that you can think you're a certain kind of person or a certain kind of an artist, and you can live with that belief until it's tested. And then you realise you're not like that at all. I think the graffiti connection is very close. In the same way that if you graffiti a wall and somebody wants to deface that, you say, look, just find your own wall, you know. You know, you've got to have respect for everyone's space. And I don't know how it works, actually, in terms of the graffiti world, you know, what the rules are, but I think there are rules there about what you do to somebody else's work. I'm 55 now. I began after I left college, 78. I think the thing that's been consistent is that I make things. I've always liked making things. I've always written notes and written about things. So I think there's been a consistency there and a curiosity, I think, that's been there. But I also think that I've never been interested in a particular medium for a long time. I will make work out whatever's available. So if there's a video camera there, I make it out of video work. If there's a sound piece, I make it out of sound. If there's a cardboard, I love the challenge of making new things in new ways. The first part of my life, I tried to be a painter for a long time. And I did an MA in painting, and it took me a long time to realise that I was a really, really, really crap painter. And being self-critical is the most important skill I think I've developed, actually, over that period of time. It's one thing I can say I'm okay at, I think. But I don't think there's different phases or phases that I've gone through. I'm not outgrown drawing or anything. I mean, I will go back and do drawing again full-time if a project needs that. In 78, there wasn't anything digital. But in 73, when I was at college, I was making videos then. But that was on old real tape. So I think artists have always embraced technology. And I think I've added that on, kind of bolted it onto what I do. When I first used a digital camera, actually on a phone, I really hated the fact that you had to delay on it, because you'd take a picture and then you'd move, and of course it would just click a bit a second later. But then I really enjoyed that delay. And I made lots and lots of work with my phone camera. Just because that delay can do something, you can delay things and make interesting shots. So I think, like everything, once you get hold of something, as an artist, our first instinct is how we can screw it up, you know, how we can play with it. Like with the scanner, I bought a new scanner to scan the slides in. But I tried to scan some flat slides in and put some tape, taped it up, and because that tape let some light into it, got these very strange shapes coming in to the scanner. So I'm going to start working on that now and start working on using the scanner as a kind of means to make work. I think artists, we do things wrong. That's what we do. I did a European lecture a few years ago called How to Do Things Wrong. You know, I buy a pen in the shop. You know, I take it apart and look at it. And you think about ink. You know, why is the ink staying in there? And how does it stay in there? What if I just broke it? I cut it. How would the ink come out? And how much ink is there in this pen? I think it's an instinctive thing for people that are curious. If there was a button somewhere and someone said, don't press this button, you know, I'd have to press it. I couldn't help myself. In jobs I've done where it says no entry, I always go through the barriers. I can't help myself. I won't take no entry as a warning. I come from that boy kid thing where you're being naughty, you just want to do anything like that. We'd go out where it said, you know, danger, no entry. We headed straight for that, over the fence, straight into it, whatever it was. So we were curious to find out what is it that could be so dangerous, you know, railway track or the edge of a cliff or anything. And I think, you know, when you get the iPad or this kind of stuff, there's things you can't do with it. And that's the things you want to do with it, you know. Like, what if I put it upside down, or if you shake it, what happens? You know, with the iPod, is the thing where you shake it, it changes track. So what if you just kept shaking all the time? What would happen, you know? And I think that's the things that I'm curious about, is how those things can be worked. Yeah, the tape were very strict about the requirements. You know, I was allowed only limited access at the beginning, but I argued and said, I can't, like, that way I can't ring somebody up and get a key in and then get let out again. So eventually I persuaded them to give me the key. So for 3 months I had the key to the tape, to Bankside. And they said, you know, under no conditions can you take anybody else in there. Which, of course, I just took all my friends there and everything. You know, did all the things we shouldn't supposed to do. I've still got the key, actually, somewhere, but I don't think it works anymore. I guess my favourite moments are the moments when I had my friends there to look at the work. You know, working there was quite solitary, and I liked being solitary when I made the work. But I had a struggle getting work ready for this show. I took hundreds of photographs of the installations when I was there, but the problem was trying to find the right images that did something different than simply record the work. I didn't want to just simply record the work. I wanted to make new work. But I never had time to do that. So this show has given me the opportunity to have the time to look back at that material and play with it. But the tape took me 6 weeks of just looking at the material every day, trying to work out what to choose, what to select. And I eventually got something that worked, but it took a long time to do that. I think they had one or two kind of open days when people from the art were allowed in to look around the building. And so they were taking a sort of detour around by my work. But that was the only time that work was seen. I guess my favourite work was a piece called Untitled that I made in the house next door to the South London Gallery that David Thorpe invited me to do. It was now being renovated, but that was the intention when he asked me in 96. And it was simply a plaster off the wall, and it revealed the lath and plaster part of the Victorian building. I turned rows of laths out of the wall and left them on the floor. That's all I did, and I called it Untitled. And that was, to me, probably the best work I've ever done in terms of wall cuts. I didn't add anything to it at all. But it had a story that you could see, because the laths are like very thin bits of wood. And there was one section where there was a knot going through it. So you can see the history that was in some forest in probably Essex somewhere. It was cut down, put as a block, put into a sawmill, cut into strips, and then bound together, because it would have stayed together better if it was kept as it was. And then taken to Peckham, unravelled, and then the guy just simply put them back up again. So you got this x-ray of the tree on this wall. And that I found absolutely fascinating, and that's probably my favourite piece. But it was the most uncomfortable project I did, because it was in the winter and there was no windows, and it was just open spaces. It's freezing cold. And I was there for, I think, 3 to 5 weeks. And it's full of pigeon mess everywhere. And it stank, and it was horrible. There's no proper staircase, so it's a very dangerous place to be. And it was the most unpleasant thing I've ever done, I think. But the best work. I think the domestic space is my favourite space. It's my ideal space to make work in, because of its history, because of its scale and size. Because in Victorian houses, you've got different layers of plaster to cut through, so you've got lots of options where you cut and how you cut. And because we're familiar with them, to do something that makes it unfamiliar is quite magical. You know, I only barely began that project, so I'm still trying to pick that up at some point. If I can find what I'm looking for is a row of domestic houses that are going to be demolished, and I can just be given free rein for a couple of weeks, that would be fantastic to do that. I did a show once where I showed one of the documentation photographs from a piece, actually at Tate, just one image, one piece, and I put it in the show just to show what I was doing, but it got sold. And I felt very uncomfortable with that, because to me that wasn't the work, that was just documentation. And if it had no right to be an artwork, it had a right to be in a book, it had a right to be pinned on the wall to show, to document, but it had no right to be an artwork, because to me it didn't do what an artwork should do. If I could have bought that back, I would have done, but it went off somewhere in the States or something. And I just thought, well, if I went to someone's house and they said, oh, I've got your work here, I'd look at it and I kind of think, no, you haven't. So it was a bit of a struggle to know what to do with this documentation. The only way I could deal with it is by using it as raw material again and cutting it and pasting it and looking at it in a different way. And I've been doing that for the last 4 or 5 months now, and I've been really enjoying it, because now the work is, it's like new work, really. What I want from an artwork, ultimately, is that it should be profound in some way, that it should be really important, and it should change my life. I would aspire to those things. You know, when I read great poetry, it changed my life. If I had to make something that did something in the world, then I'd want it to do something that would change my life. And my work has done that. I mean, my work has changed my life. For me, that's the level the work has to operate at. So the documentation can happen if it does something other than to simply document, that it reveals another truth, if you like. One of the things I do a lot, I find, is make work that responds to other artists' work. As a response to an artist called Jasper Johns, a painter, who, when I was a student, I remember seeing his work. It affected me, and one piece was called Target, which was simply around, you know, a target. He did the flag pieces too, and he did those pieces that were quite well known. The piece was called Target. The word is fire. It was right next to a fire exit and a fire extinguishers. So this is a kind of homage to Jasper Johns in a way. And because his work was called Target, you know, I thought I'd call this Target too. He did a drawing called Broken Target. For me, probably my favourite work. So I couldn't help but make that kind of nod at his work. I think one constant phrase that goes through my head from very early on when I was making drawings when I was 16 or 17, there was a drawing I made that I called Under There Is Something, Surprisingly Nothing. And it was a drawing of a piece of paper with a corner turned up and underneath nothing. And I guess it comes down from my non-belief in religion, was the idea that there was nothing else under the surface. You know, that when you look deep down, you just see nothing. And so it's important that we think about the present, that we think about what we have, that we make the most, rather than, you know, I find all religion very difficult to understand, because my parents were communists. I grew up in a communist background. And I've changed my opinion on lots of things, but not on that. You know, I still find religion very difficult. It's a cult, you know, whether it's Christianity or Catholicism or Islam. It's not based on anything real. It's based on a fantasy. And so for me, it's at the same level as people who believe in being abducted by aliens, you know, or something. It's just as absurd to me. So I think that, you know, there's a theme in the work. It's the idea that to say there's an alternative to believing in fantasy, into the supernatural, that we can believe in the natural. I think people are naturally good, if there's such a word as natural or good. But it's also interesting how quickly people can turn into being barbaric. You know, we're not that far. I think we are medieval people still. We're 21st century technology at our disposal, but we're still... I mean, look at, you know, in Libya, I mean, there's still sieges. We still have sieges on places. We know we're doing nothing more than what they were doing hundreds of years ago. A blockade on Cuba from the Americans is a siege. We haven't gone anywhere, really. Now we've got Shakespeare, we've got Plato, we've got the poets, we've got great art. This is what's hopeful, is that despite the politicians and despite the state of the world, we've got people who care about each other and do great things. I think it's creativity that's the victor. I think one of the other things I learnt from my parents was... My mother, I mean, she's an East Ender. She's born in Bethnal Green, you know. But she talks about the English. A lot of her neighbours are from Asian neighbours. And she goes, oh, they're great. Unlike the English, you know. And so I've grown up always being international. It's always been important to me to be international. You know, I've not been surprised, but whenever I've gone anywhere around the world, I've met people exactly the same as me. I don't see any difference, you know, different language. There's different kind of cultures. But the thing underneath that culture, which is people, is exactly the same. I've seen any difference in that at all. It's all the same. That humanity is exactly the same. And I think also, I'm from the East End. I don't think of myself as a Londoner in a way. I think of myself as part of the world. There's nothing that I can identify with in a way. I'm just people. There are codes we have, and they're important. You know, I believe in them. You know, it's amazing, that thing that Gandhi said once. He said, there are many causes which I'm prepared to die for, but none I'm prepared to kill for. And I think that it's really important that we have a moral code, that things are wrong. Murder is wrong, you know. What's interesting is that though we as a country say murder is wrong, then we go and do it. we go and bomb Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever it may be and kill, you know, hundreds of thousands of civilians as collateral damage, and somehow it's okay if you do that. And that I can't understand. And I think, how can you ask young people to respect law if the country doesn't respect the law? We have very poor moral codes, actually, I think. I don't think I'm as good as Gandhi. I don't think I could say that. If my life was in danger, I would kill to survive. I'm not a pacifist. But to think very hard about what you're prepared to do and why you're prepared to do that. I can see every reason why you shouldn't eat meat, but I do, you know. I would like to be a pacifist. I don't think I have the courage to be that. It's the first time ever that I think I would have put together a show like this. Normally the shows I do are single works, usually made on site, or they're showing a work that's been made somewhere. It's usually been a one-off thing. I've shown small things in some group shows before. This is the first time that I put together the whole, more or less, everything that I've done, whether it's text works, audio pieces, video works. And so it's exciting for me to be able to put these things together and look at them. So it's a big montage of all these different things. And David Thorpe's creating the show. It's been great to have him to work with, to look at the work through his eyes too. There's lots of things missing from the show. There's lots of bits of work that I've done that won't be in the show at all because there's limited space. But, you know, it's quite a big work. There's going to be 50 works in the show. And probably only a handful have been seen before. I think you're limited to what you can do on your own. You need support. If you're doing big projects somewhere, like in Caracas, I had a lot of support there. You know, Lisa Blackmore was on site. She lives there and she coordinated the project and produced it, really. The singers, the musicians, the film crew that were there. You know, if I had to do all that stuff, and often I do all that stuff, it's exhausting. Because, you know, you do all these negotiations, logistics, and by the time you get to make the work, you know, you're fed up with it by that time. So I realised to continue, I need to have that support. It just takes an awful lot of that stuff out of your hands and you're able to kind of just concentrate on the work and what you want to do. So I hope the show is a springboard for those things. As all artists, you need to have that. The fact that someone has the faith and says, we think you're worth supporting, is enormously important and very moving, because often artists, we work on our own in their studios. We get very little feedback. We get very little chance to share work often. And there are tons of studio blocks around, you know, and those artists never get a chance to show their work or get support. And sometimes just a little bit of support is enough to sustain you. I think sometimes, you know, money isn't the solution. You know, funding isn't the solution. Sometimes just the support is important. And so the Hamlins gave me that award. I was very proud to have that award. But also it gave me financial stability for a few years. And I don't think I could be doing this show now without that support. Broken Voices, that was set up to be a kind of a piece based on Monteverdi. That was the original idea, which we kept through the whole project. And for me, the project was really about broken communication. So there's lots of sections that I filmed with phones and TV and all kinds of things. But actually, when it came to showing the work in Bexhill, I just showed a 23-minute section of it. So I never really showed that piece in its full. In fact, I very rarely do show pieces in their full length because normally they're too long. So one day I'll go back to that piece. But with that piece, I worked with Ian Dearden and Linda Hurst. Ian is a composer and also a sound designer. So both their skills were useful, and I've learned an awful lot from both of them. In fact, I was at school, really. I felt like, when I was working with them, just learning all the time. And I pestered them all kinds of questions about, you know, why is this, why is that? But with Ian, we did a series of four performances towards the video piece. So we kind of workshopped and played with it, and we did the first one in Venice in the Biennale in a church. The second one was in Liverpool, in the A Foundation. And that was a three-roomed piece. So we just took the audience from room to room. Then we ended up with the final piece at the Riverside Studios in a show called Tête à Tête, which is the opera festival. So we got invited to do that. And I was very curious to suddenly do something, 1 minute doing it in a church, then doing it in a huge art gallery space, and then doing it on stage in a theatre, which I hadn't done before. So I quite loved that opportunity. And towards the end of the project, Ian came in one morning, just doing a kind of run through before we did the piece at Riverside. And he brought in two bits of music that he'd composed using Monteverdi in two sections, an early 3 bars from the first part of the music and 5 bars from the second part of the music. The piece of music was called Dearest Seraphim for Three Voices. It was a very simple 6-minute piece that was the foundation for the whole. And it was absolutely beautiful. It was really, really, you know, perfect, what I wanted, really. So I thought, it's so good that then I recut all the film to go to the music. So in a sense, I was like the lyricist to his music, you know, the visual lyricist. And I really enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed cutting everything back to what it was into this new thing to go inside with the music. So I think it varies, it changes. I like doing things differently, you know, each time for my own entertainment. So often with singers, like with Linda, also in Caracas, you know, I'd workshop for 5 weeks with the students there, trying things out, and in the end, they're improvising. There's a margin that we're working within, you know, and we rehearse that quite carefully. You know, when it comes to the performance, they will or will not do what they want to do, and they will do different things and play with it. I said, you know, listen to each other. If you hear a sound you want to repeat or play with, do it. I kind of like not having that control over it. I kind of like it. I think communication is a very important part of what art is and what we do. That can be done in all kinds of ways. I mean, it cannot be obvious. You know, I can communicate with Shakespeare. It's a one-way conversation, but I get it from what he says. There's an idea to do an experimental art school project, which is happening hopefully next year, which I've been piloting for 2 years now. I did a teaching fellowship in an art school, which is the only time I've been in an art school as a teacher. Although I didn't really teach, I did my own thing, and I played with things. I think it's really important that we do talk to each other about stuff. You know, what I miss in an art school is the ability to be critical about stuff, to look at things. In the little bit of teaching I have done, I've been quite horrified how little criticism goes on. Being self-critical is really, really important. To look at your work and go, it didn't work. You know, I'm constantly rejecting things of my own work. You know, I'm very tough on myself. And when I preview my work to my friends, you know, they're pretty tough too. And I want that. You know, there's no point in being kind about it. You know, be abrupt, be tough, you know. There's lots of art school initiatives happening right now. There's going to be one at the Hayward, I think, next year. But there's lots of different types of initiatives in Magister, in Hull, you know, and I think it's really good that people are saying, well, we don't need an art school. They're saying, the question is, do you have to go to art school to be an artist? And I think that's a question that's interesting, particularly right now when the facilities have been offered at art school are decreasing, space is hardly there. I mean, I was horrified when I went into the studios in Wimbledon 2 years ago and saw the sculpture studios, and, you know, they barely had a desktop to work on. I mean, it was unbelievable. We had whole spaces to play with individually. They're crammed together. There's no longer art history taught at art school. There's very little practical training on anything. You know, I just think that it's just a processing. You know, people have been processed into kind of, and I think the result of that is an awful lot of mediocrity in the art galleries. You're just not getting anything coming out of there that's interesting. I think that's a knock-on effect. And I think with the cuts now in education and the arts and the increasing fees, we need something else. And I think these different alternatives, you know, and I think what I'm trying to do is just one of those small things, is to offer a different way of learning. It's about debate, it's about talking about things, it's about discussing the point of education, is it good or bad, and all those kind of things. But also it's going to be about practically learning things, talking to experts in painting and sculpture and film. Because artists, well, probably everybody, I guess, you know, we're curious about how things are actually done. So if I go and see a film director hearing a talk, I don't want to hear about their ideas or their concepts. You know, I want to know, how did they make that shot? How did you get that sound? How did you do this? You know. So I'm trying to invent something where I can be a student. That's my ambition. I don't want to be a teacher. I don't think I'm any good at that anyway. I don't own anything or be directive of anything. So it's going to be student-led. I've been an artist now since 1978 and usually, possibly, continue to work most of that time. There's been a few gaps in that when I nearly gave up making art altogether and didn't. I had to do different jobs at different times, and so it's been tough to find the time to make the work. But there came a point in 1994 when I was working for a community arts group for 5 years where I got the chance to do these installations in these buildings, and I just thought, this is what I need to do. So I gave up the job. I had no chance of earning an income, but I'd give up the job. Actually, the interesting thing was the year after that, I earned more money than I had in the job.